Hello. We continue our work in Chapter 15, Reality and the Integral Yoga. Sri Aurobindo has strongly asserted that an integral knowledge presupposes an integral reality, that an absolute expressed as sheer oneness in its true being is not alone the real, that this reality has an inherent expressive power to manifest itself as a multiplicity, which is expressive, again, of that real being. Both being and becoming are poles of reality. They are not mutually exclusive. And he founds this insight clearly upon what is possible to the highest human experience, and calls our attention back to the Upanishads to show clearly that the Upanishads are both affirming of that reality beyond what we would call space and time, but also that that reality is intimately involved in all the processes of the universe here and now. Bringing the Upanishads into this takes away from the argument of Shankara, who bases much of his Advaita absolutist monistic philosophy upon arguments drawn from and reflective upon the Upanishads. So very interesting that Sri Aurobindo has directly confuted Shankara's view by drawing upon the same sources that Shankara used. Well, that's interesting. He has set this argument and he continues it today in our reading with this paragraph. There is, then, in the conception or the realization of the truth of the Absolute, no inherent inevitable consequence of a rejection or a dissolution of the truth of the universe. The idea of an essentially unreal universe manifested somehow by an inexplicable power of illusion, the absolute Brahman regarding it not, or aloof and not affecting it, even as it is unaffected by it, is at bottom a carrying over, an imposing or imputation, adhyaropa, of an incapacity of our mental consciousness to that so as to limit it. Sri Aurobindo is here being a bit arch and ironic because he's used the term adhyaropa, which means imposition, something which Shankara uses in his own logic, and he's used it to undermine Shankara's standpoint here. Our mental consciousness, when it passes beyond its limits, loses its own way and means of knowledge and tends towards inactivity or cessation. It loses at the same time, or tends to have no further hold on its former contents, no continuing conception of the reality of that which once was to it all that was real. We impute to absolute Parabrahman, conceived as non-manifest forever, a corresponding inability or separation or aloofness from what has become or seems now to us unreal. It must, like our mind in its cessation or self-extinction, be by its very nature of pure absoluteness, void of all connection with this world of apparent manifestation, incapable of any supporting cognition or dynamic maintenance of it that gives it a reality, or if there is such a cognition, it must be of the nature of an is that is not, a magical Maya. So he's saying that we transfer what we know from our own experience and impose it upon that. And he continues, but there is no binding reason to suppose that this chasm must exist. This chasm, which is created by our logic, extending from our human experience upon that. What our relative human consciousness is or is not capable of is no test or standard of an absolute capacity. Its conceptions cannot be applied to an absolute self-awareness. What is necessary for our mental ignorance in order to escape from itself cannot be the necessity of the absolute, which has no need of self-escape and no reason for refusing to cognize whatever is to it cognizable. So the absolute is not trapped by the faulty logic of the mind, which wishes to impose, to superimpose its ideas upon an absolute which exceeds it. You can imagine that if you took your hand and you reached out to grab the whole of the floor before you, how much of it could you grasp? That much the mind knows. Can it really impose upon Parabrahman what is the nature of its own reality? He continues, there is that unmanifest unknowable. There is this manifest knowable, partly manifest to our ignorance, manifest entirely to the divine knowledge which holds it in its own infinity. This probably echoes for you with one of the chants that we do each time we meet. Purnam madaha, purnam idam. That is full. This is full. There is that unknowable. There is the manifestation. The manifestation is taken out of that which is above. Taking out that manifestation from that which is above, the above is not exhausted. It remains whole, unimpaired, untouched. If it is true, he writes, that neither our ignorance nor our utmost and widest mental knowledge can give us a hold of the unknowable, still it is also true that whether through our knowledge or through our ignorance, that variously manifests itself. For it cannot be manifesting something other than itself, since nothing else can exist. In this variety of manifestation, there is that oneness, and through the diversity, we can touch the oneness. Simply put, if only that is, then anything that is possible to our experience cannot be an illusion. It must be real. It must be drawn from that and partake of that reality. But even so, even accepting this coexistence, it is still possible to pass a final verdict and sentence of condemnation on the becoming and decide on the necessity of a renunciation of it and a return into the absolute being. This verdict can be based on the distinction between the real reality of the absolute and the partial and misleading reality of the relative universe. This, too, is an argument often cited by Vedantists in denying reality to the world or ultimate value to the world. It can have only a relative reality, they say. So he'll examine this argument for a moment. For we have, in this unfolding of knowledge, the two terms of the one and the many, as we have the two terms of the finite and the infinite, of that which becomes and of that which does not become, but forever is, of that which takes form and of that which does not take form, of spirit and matter, of the supreme superconscient, and the nethermost inconscience. In this dualism, and to get away from it, it is open to us to define knowledge as the possession of one term and the possession of the other as ignorance. The ultimate of our life would then be a drawing away from the lower reality of the becoming to the greater reality of the being, a leap from the ignorance to the knowledge, and a rejection of the ignorance. A departure from the many into the one, from the finite into the infinite, from form into the formless, from the life of the material universe into the spirit, from the hold of the inconscient upon us into the superconscient existence. In this solution, there is supposed to be a fixed opposition, an ultimate irreconcilability in each case between the two terms of our being. Or else, if both are a means of the manifestation of the Brahman, the lower is a false or imperfect clue, a means that must fail, a system of values that cannot ultimately satisfy us. Dissatisfied with the confusions of the multiplicity, disdainful of even the highest light and power and joy that it can reveal, we must drive beyond to the absolute one-pointedness and one-standingness in which all self-variation ceases. And I caution you, we're in the middle of an argument which is not his. This is not his position. Unable by the claim of the infinite upon us to dwell forever in the bonds of the finite or to find there satisfaction and largeness and peace, we have to break all bonds of individual and universal nature, destroy all values, symbols, images, self-definitions, limitations of the illimitable, and lose all littleness and division in the self that is forever satisfied with its own infinity. The many must be absorbed back into the one. The noisy multitude must become that silent alone. Disgusted with forms, disillusioned of their false and transient attractions, wearied and discouraged by their fleeting impermanence and vain round of recurrence, we must escape from the cycles of nature into the formlessness and featurelessness of permanent being. Ashamed of matter and its grossness, impatient of the purposeless stir and trouble of life, tired out by the goalless running of mind, or convinced of the vanity of all its aims and objects, we have to release ourselves into the eternal repose and purity of the spirit. The inconscient is a sleep or a prison, the conscient a round of strivings without ultimate issue or the wanderings of a dream. We must wake into the superconscious where all darkness of night and half-lights cease in the self-luminous bliss of the eternal. The eternal is our refuge. All the rest are false values, the ignorance and its mazes, a self-bewilderment of the soul in phenomenal nature. If the phrasing is powerful, do not buy the argument nonetheless. It is specious. You've heard their version, now hear his. Our conception of the knowledge and the ignorance rejects this negation and the oppositions on which it is founded. It points to a larger, if more difficult, issue of reconciliation. Well, we've encountered the term issue twice in the last few sentences. Again, he uses it in the pure sense, not relating to topic, but meaning to go out, to gain a forward advance. It points to a larger, if more difficult, issue of reconciliation. So this is the way to a real solution. For we see that these apparently opposite terms of one and many, form and the formless, finite and infinite, are not so much opposites as complements of each other. Not alternating values of the Brahman, which in its creation perpetually loses oneness to find itself in multiplicity and, unable to discover itself in multiplicity, loses it again to recover oneness, but double and concurrent values which explained each other, not hopelessly incompatible alternatives, but two faces of the one reality which can lead us to it by our realization of both together and not only by testing each separately. Even though such separate testing may be a legitimate or even an inevitable step or part of the process of knowledge. Concurrent, by the way, means running together. So they can coexist. They are not antagonistic to each other. But he says in this last phrase or two that indeed, essentially, gaining that spiritual knowledge, gaining freedom from the appearances of the ignorance, is a useful step in growing into the greater knowledge. Knowledge, he writes, is no doubt the knowledge of the One, the realization of the Being. Ignorance is a self-oblivion of being. Self-oblivion, in other words, being has imposed this darkness upon itself. It has disappeared according to its own will. It has not been imposed upon it. Nobody has done anything to Brahman to make it hide in darkness. Brahman has descended into darkness by its own volition. Ignorance is a self-oblivion of being, the experience of separateness in the multiplicity, and a dwelling or circling in the ill-understood maze of becomings. But this is cured by the soul in the becoming growing into knowledge, into awareness of the being which becomes in the multiplicity all these existences and can so become because their truth is already there in its timeless existence. The integral knowledge of Brahman is a consciousness in possession of both together, and the exclusive pursuit of either closes the vision to one side of the truth of the omnipresent reality. Omnipresent reality, the title of Book One of the Life Divine, it's everywhere. The truth, the reality, the conscious force of the Supreme is everywhere. And for us to have an integral knowledge, we can't simply go to the bright side. We have also to descend into the dark multiplicity, to find there the secret oneness, which comes from above. The possession of the being who is beyond all becomings brings to us freedom from the bonds of attachment and ignorance in the cosmic existence, and brings by that freedom a free possession of the becoming and of the cosmic existence. The knowledge of the becoming is a part of knowledge. It acts as an ignorance only because we dwell imprisoned in it. Avidyayam antare, without possessing the oneness of the being, which is its base, its stuff, its spirit, its cause of manifestation, and without which it could not be possible. Avidyayam means within the ignorance or inside non-knowledge. It's actually taken from a couple of Upanishads, the Katha Upanishad 1.2.5 and the Mundaka Upanishad 1.2.8, where it says more fully, avidyayam antare vartamannaha, living and moving within the ignorance, it says. In fact, the Brahman is one not only in a featureless oneness beyond all relation, but in the very multiplicity of the cosmic existence. Aware of the works of the dividing mind, but not itself limited by it, it finds its oneness as easily in the many, in relations, in becoming, as in any withdrawal from the many, from relations, from becoming. Ourselves also, to possess even its oneness fully, must possess it, since it is there, since all is that, in the infinite self-variation of the cosmos. The infinity of the multiplicity finds itself explained and justified only when it is contained and possessed in the infinity of the One. In the Gita, we would hear Krishna exhorting us to come to His nature, Madbhava, and in that to find the greater reality in which all contraries are embraced in all uniting oneness. But also, the infinity of the One pours itself out and possesses itself in the infinity of the many. To be capable of that outpouring of its energies, as well as not to lose itself in it, not to recoil, defeated from its boundlessness and endlessness of vicissitudes and differences, as well as not to be self-divided by its variations, is the divine strength of the free Purusha, the conscious soul in its possession of its own immortal self-knowledge. So bringing back here the principle of personhood is a very interesting suggestion and connotation. It is the truth of our own soul. And if Krishna as Purushottama can call us to live in His nature, and that absolute oneness, which is also the source of all the multiplicity, and to dwell simultaneously in both states, if Krishna as Purushottama can achieve that, He offers that to all incarnate souls as a possibility. And if we achieve that, then we have integrated both sides, being and becoming, and have an integral knowledge. We know it from identity. We are not lost in the play of the variable. We are still one. And in the oneness, we have not negated the possibility and the play of the many. The finite self-variations of the self, in which the mind, losing self-knowledge, is caught and dispersed among the variations, are yet not the denials, but the endless expression of the infinite, and have no other meaning or reason for existence. The infinite, too, while it possesses its delight of limitless being, finds also the joy of that very limitlessness in its infinite self-definition in the universe. And by the way, the music that I played for you tonight was played by the mother on the 12th of March, 1960, and she titled it Joy. The divine being is not incapable of taking innumerable forms because he is beyond all form in his essence, nor by assuming them does he lose his divinity, but pours out rather in them the delight of his being and the glories of his Godhead. This gold does not cease to be gold because it shapes itself into all kinds of ornaments and coins itself into many currencies and values. Nor does the earth power, principle of all this figured material existence, lose her immutable divinity because she forms herself into habitable worlds, throws herself out in the hills and hollows, and allows herself to be shaped into utensils of the hearth and household, or as hard metal into the weapon and the engine. Matter, substance itself, subtle or dense, mental or material, is form and body of spirit, and would never have been created if it could not be made a basis for the self-expression of the spirit. The apparent inconscience of the material universe holds in itself darkly all that is eternally self-revealed in the luminous superconscient. To reveal it in time is the slow and deliberate delight of nature and the aim of her cycles. So this is his view, and it's wonderful. And it is not mere rhetoric, it is not faulty logic. This is based on deep and intimate experience of self and world, and of what is beyond both self and world, and yet is self and world. But there are other conceptions of reality, other conceptions of the nature of knowledge, which demand consideration. There is the view that all that exists is a subjective creation of mind, a structure of consciousness, and that the idea of an objective reality, self-existent, independent of consciousness, is an illusion, since we have and can have no evidence of any such independent self-existence of things. This is the first kind of subjectivism, a kind of idealistic philosophy, which, of course, those of you who have studied Yogacara in Buddhism or Berkeley's philosophy in the West would know. This way of seeing may lead to the affirmation of the creative consciousness as the sole reality, or to the denial of all existence and the affirmation of non-existence, or a nescient zero, is the sole reality. For in one view, the objects constructed by consciousness have no intrinsic reality. They are merely structures. Even the consciousness that constructs them is itself only a flux of perceptions that assume an appearance of connection and continuity and create a sense of continuous time. But in reality, these things have no stable basis, as they are only an appearance of reality. This answers to a type of Buddhist psychology. This would mean that the reality is an eternal absence at once of all self-conscious existence, and of all that constitutes movement of existence. Knowledge would mean a return to that from the appearance of the constructed universe. There would be a double and complete self-extinction, the disappearance of Purusha, the cessation or extinction of Prakriti. For the conscious soul and nature are the two terms of our being and comprehend all that we mean by existence, and the negation of both is the absolute nirvana. What is real, then, must be either an inconscience in which this flux and these structures appear, or a superconscience beyond all idea of self or existence. But this view of the universe is only true of the appearance of things when we regard our surface mind as the whole of consciousness, As a description of the working of that mind, it is valid. There, undoubtedly, all looks like a flux and a construction by an impermanent consciousness. You see, because if there is a real and the mind is looking at it and there's a separation, then is that reality really there, or is the mind simply misinterpreting what it sees? The mind misinterpreting that it exists and misinterpreting the temporary construction of what's before it as being a reality, a thing. But this cannot prevail as a whole account of existence if there is a greater and deeper self-knowledge and world knowledge, a knowledge by identity, a consciousness to which that knowledge is normal, and a being of which that consciousness is the eternal self-awareness. For then the subjective and the objective can be real and intimate to that consciousness and being. Both can be something of itself, sides of its identity, authentic to its existence. And so you see, he's brought back in the concepts of sat and chit, that there is a reality, a positive, actual, real, and this reality is conscious. It cannot be unconscious. This goes all the way back to early chapters. So again, we revisit these themes frequently as we go rolling through the pages of the Life Divine. We come again and again upon the same arguments which he has to make over and over again, depending on the context of the philosophy he's addressing. We continue. On the other hand, if the constructing mind or consciousness is real and the soul reality, then the universe of material beings and objects may have an existence, but it is purely subjective, structural, made by consciousness out of itself, maintained by it, dissolving into it in their disappearance. 4. If there is nothing else, no essential existence or being supporting the creative power, and there is not either a sustaining void or nihil, then this consciousness which creates everything must itself have or be an existence or a substance. If it can make structures, they must be constructions out of its own substance or forms of its own existence. That makes sense. A consciousness which is not that of an existence or is not itself an existence must be an unreality, a perceptive force of a void, or in a void, raising there unreal structures made out of nothing, a proposition which is not easily acceptable unless all others prove to be invalid. It then becomes apparent that what we see as consciousness must be a being or an existence out of whose substance of consciousness all is created. We're back to Satchit-Ananda. And there we will rest tonight. We'll put our bookmarks there and come back next Sunday and continue. Before closing altogether, let's share a passage from Savitri. This is from Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds. This is the opening of Canto 11, The Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Mind. There seized the limits of the laboring power, but being and creation seized not there. For thought transcends the circles of mortal mind. It is greater than its earthly instrument. The Godhead crammed into mind's narrow space escapes on every side into some vast that is a passage to infinity. It moves eternal in the spirit's field, a runner towards the far spiritual light, a child and servant of the Spirit's force. but mine too falls back from a nameless peak. His being stretched beyond the sight of thought. For the spirit is eternal and unmade, and not by thinking was its greatness born, and not by thinking can its knowledge come. It knows itself, and in itself it lives. It moves where no thought is, nor any form. Its feet are steadied upon finite things. Its wings can dare to cross the infinite. Arriving into his ken, a wonder space of great and marvelous meetings called his steps, where thought leaned on a vision beyond thought, and shaped a world from the unthinkable. On peaks imagination cannot tread, in the horizons of a tireless sight, under a blue veil of eternity, the splendors of ideal mind were seen, outstretched across the boundaries of things known. Origin of the little that we are, instinct with the endless more that we must be, a prop of all that human strength enacts, creator of hopes by earth unrealized, it spreads beyond the expanding universe, it wings beyond the boundaries of dream, it overtops the ceiling of life's soar. Awake in a luminous sphere unbound by thought, exposed to omniscient immensities, it casts on our world its great crowned influences, its speed that outstrips the ambling of the hours, its force that strides invincibly through time, its might that bridge the gulf twixt man and God, its lights that combat ignorance and death. Thank you for joining me once again. Namaste. Jai Ma.